This programme was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, Irirangi Tumotu, MPR.
Listening to live and on-demand shows has never been easier on MPR. All you have to do is go to the App Store or Play Store on your device and search up Access Internet Radio NZ. Select and download the first option at the top of the list. Once you've downloaded the app, the next step is to open the app and look for MPR. Once found, select it and then browse freely. Supported by New Zealand On Air.
Welcome to Manawatu Conversations, recollections of the past and sometimes opinions about the future.
Today we have with us
Jim Eason,
Stuart Burks,
and Bruce Markwell.
Now,
Jim, I'd like to ask you a couple of questions, and one of them relates to your time in Rotary. And I know that you had quite a bit to do with the formation or the setting up of our historic book, what is known as 5:30 Wednesday. Can you just talk us through how that happened and why and how you got involved?
Yes, I can, actually, Bruce. It was a project which I was very keen on. The Peter Ender, as you well remember, was a very keen supporter and did a lot of the writing and a lot of the work behind that book. And the other one was Dick Rostrum, and Dick was a wonderful guy. He was had been an anaesthetist at Palmerston North Hospital. An amazing man was Dick Rostrum. And so between us, we decided that the history of the club was really very worthwhile recording, and so we did a fair bit of research and got the records. And but I must confess that it was Peter that did the bulk of the donkey work. I really can't take that away from him. He did a tremendous amount, and we helped wherever we could, with photos, with digging out records, of making lists of who'd been president and when, and all those sort of things which are inherent in that type of publication.
Okay. So how old was Terrace End Rotary Club when you
together? From memory, it was 25, 30 years old. We hadn't made it to 50, but it was getting up. It could have been 40 years, in fact.
I think that's right, Jim. I think it was 40 years, because we've produced...
And it was certainly a notable length of time and an occasion, and it made it worthwhile to do.
Mm. Yeah. Since then, it's been updated every 10 years, so we've had a 50 and then a 60. The last one was 60 last year, I think it was. So, and the other thing, you were president in 1997-98.
Yes.
But prior to you becoming president, the club, and you and Dick Rostrum, and I think probably a couple of others, had nominated Catherine Hamlin for a World Understanding Award. Can you tell us what happened and the effort that went into making that application to Rotary International so that an award could be made to Catherine?
One of my fondest memories, actually, that particular effort, it was driven again by Dick Rostrum. Dick was at medical school with Catherine's husband, Reg. So that was how the association began. The two of them did an absolutely wonderful job in Addis Ababa. They got in there, they found the terrible situation a lot of girls were in, trying to push out large babies with, and they were just very young. And they were getting into all sorts of medical difficulties. The Hamlins became extremely emotionally involved with these girls. These kids were put into huts on their own because they were rather smelly and non-desirable, and they were often attacked and killed by hyenas. That's how bad it was. And
was that the traditional? Was that the traditional approach to childbirth then?
Well, it really was. Nobody knew what to do with them or how to help them.
This was a fistula problem, wasn't it? This was specifically a fistula problem.
It was indeed.
Which means what? It's not your standard childbirth then?
No, it's not your standard childbirth. I'm not a medical person.
The uterus actually splits. And they developed surgical techniques to help these girls. Some of the stories that Catherine told were absolutely heartrending. They really honestly were, about a girl that had had the... she got a bus ride right across Ethiopia, and because of urine problems and so on, they made her sit on a tin and had sharp edges which had cut into her, and oh, she was in a terrible mess by the time they got her to Addis Ababa. And they developed these surgical techniques and helped these girls in the most wonderful way. And it was, I think, one of the most heartrending things I've ever been involved with.
So what were they doing? They found this out, and they were back in...
They established...
Fundraising, or...
They established a hospital, and they actually initiated some surgical techniques to help. They taught a lot of locals how to do the operation.
So they were experts in this themselves?
Yes, they were. Catherine had been a gynaecologist in Australia. She was an Australian, but Reg was a New Zealander, and they were absolutely wonderful people. We wrote to all sorts of people to get support, getting a letter from people like the Archbishop of Canterbury and so on was really very heartening. And how much support we got from people was absolutely staggering. And I didn't find it in the least bit surprising that Rotary International helped out in a very realistic way.
It was quite a big award, and it was something...
About 100,000 US.
It was 100,000 US, that's right, yes. And it was amazing from the point of view that it came from a relatively small club in Rotary terms in the world, and not from one of the big countries and the main centres. So it was a job well done.
Yes, it was, wasn't it?
Mm. Mm. Jim, another question, and it's outside of Rotary, that I'd like you to sort of just elaborate on. I believe at some stage you and some others brought in some buffaloes into New Zealand.
Yes, I did. This was after I left DSIR and I joined the Ministry of Agriculture and Fisheries Research. And my regional director was a very innovative sort of a man. And Bill Kane was his name, wonderful guy. And Bill and I sat down and we were, after all, a research organisation, and so we were looking for opportunities to improve New Zealand's agriculture and our agricultural opportunities around the world. Now, we all know that the Asians don't eat beef. There's a religious Hindu thing against it. They're not particularly fond of our dairy product because they don't like the keratins, the yellow in our dairy product. But they do eat buffalo. Now, buffalo, as you know, are their main beast of burden. They plough paddies with them, they do all sorts of things. And these things were dying at about 20 years of age, and then they'd cut up a tough old carcass, and that was the meat that was available. We were looking at rising two-year-old males and that sort of thing, and it's wonderful, wonderful meat, I might add. It's beautifully marbled. It's a very tasty beef. The dairy product that buffalo produces is pure white. They're very good producers, and they are, how else would I say? They can survive on virtually nothing. Their dietary requirements are absolutely minimal. They keep in production for at least twice as long as dairy cows. Dairy cows at 10 or 12 are over the hill, 25 and you're still going on buff. Mm-hmm. And they are the most remarkable animals. And we did a lot of background research and decided that it would be worthwhile to look at the potential for farming buffalo in New Zealand. So with that in mind, we did a lot of background research and looking into things. And then we went up to Darwin and with a guy up there, we caught, captured about 400 cows in the Kakadu.
Were these wild animals at that point mm-hmm. in time? Were these wild animals or feral
animals?
Oh, yes,
they're totally wild animals. Mm. And so we took them out of the Kakadu and held them at Catherine for a considerable period. And buffaloes are remarkable animals. I can tell you honestly that I was stood in a paddock of buffalo that were a week out of the wild. And I could walk through that paddock and only have to keep an eye open for one cow that was a bit stroppy still. I actually hand-fed a bull that was 24 hours out of the wild. They are the most amazing animals. They can survive. Believe it or not, the main feed they get when they're using them for ploughing paddy is the thrash rice straw. Sometimes they throw in a bit of chicken poo to give them a bit of additional nitrogen, but that's the sort of food they're getting. And when you see them in the Kakadu and the far north of Australia at the end of the dry season, cattle are leaning against a tree to have enough strength to stand up. The buffs are coming out sleek and fat, and they're eating stuff like pandanus, which is a lot less digestible than gorse. And
what's pandanus?
Pandanus. It's a plant which grows up there in the far north. It's a spiky sort of a plant, and it's
succulent, is it?
Yes, a type of succulent, and it's has very little in the way of nutrition. But buffalo are quite staggering. Now, there are two sorts of buffalo, and this needs to be told to you. The swamp buffalo, which we're talking about here, comes from Timor, across through that sort of stretch and up into China. The river buffalo, which has horns, instead of sweeping across the brow like swamp buffaloes do, they come out the side and drop and curl up. And those are river buffalo, and they're a different species, but they are they have been more developed than the swamp buffalo. They have various breeds of river buff, things called Niliravi and various breeds of them. But in the time of the Crusades, the Crusaders brought back into Europe river buffalo. And they're in Italy and up into Bulgaria. And so river buffalo are probably more developed as a dairy breed than swamp buffalo. They have a very long lactation, about 340-odd days as a lactation.
They're, so what does that mean? You mean each year they're producing milk?
Over that amount of time. So you haven't got that big drop-off that you've got in dairying.
But they need warm climate, do they?
No, they don't. No, that's what I'm saying. That they're up into Bulgaria and so on, so they get some pretty hard winters up into there. They are... The hides are extremely valuable. They can be split up to seven times a buffalo hide. You can actually split them, and so you get a lot of leather.
Horizontal layers.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So you sort of shave them off in
different
layers.
Yes. Yes, indeed. Okay. And you can get all
that
sorts of
with other sorts of hide, with cow hide and so on. Can you do split them at all?
Yes, yes. You can make all sorts of things from buffalo leather.
Oh, no, but I mean the Western type cows that we use, are they the same, or deer hide?
Oh, no. So no, you can't get anywhere near that number of splits off a cow hide.
Would you split a cow hide?
You can do, but there's certainly two or three at the most. Okay. With buffalo, you can get up to seven splits. And that's quite remarkable. They are so one. They eat and can, you know, their nutritional requirements is very low. Two, their dairy production is very high. The butter fat, the amount of time they milk, and the, you know, the volumes they produce. Three, they are extremely easy animals to manage. Talk to and to, you know, move with, and you can go out to a paddock full of buffaloes and say, "Come on," and they'll follow you. You know, they really are amazing animals, and I've got a huge amount of regard for them. There are not a lot of buffalo in New Zealand. Unfortunately, the herd that we brought in, we brought it down to Alice Springs and then trucked it down to Adelaide, carved them down there, and then we found that there was a blue tongue teeter in some of the cows, and we weren't able, I think we only had two that didn't have blue tongue teeter, so we couldn't bring many of the cows. But
so
we
that's
bought
a
the
disease, was it?
Hmm?
That's a disease.
A blue tongue is a disease that we don't have in New Zealand, and the Australians don't have either. But there was a definite blue tongue teeter present, and so that put the chop on them. But we bought in the cows and calves, and the calves at Flockhouse, and it was at about that time that the MAFTEC and DSIR thing split up or disappeared into Crown Research, and nobody was very interested in the buffaloes, and they got sold off, which is it, to my eternal regret, because I think it was one of the most far-seeing pieces of research that had been done for a long time.
No one else has tried that since?
That's not true. There are a number of herds of buffalo around. There's a herd out in the Kairanga. It's a small herd, but it's a they're swamp buffalo. There's a herd of river buffalo up on the tip of East Cape. I've seen them. There's a river herd, river buff herd in Auckland, and they are milking those and producing buffalo cheeses.
So are these people that have these buffalo, these smaller herds, are they using the milk themselves, or are they sending it outside
This is something which is quite interesting, Bruce. I, for instance, the guy up on East Cape is interested in producing buffalo meat.
Right.
And but he's got river buff, whereas swamp buffalo is probably a better grade of meat. And the guy down on Kairanga is interested in producing milk, but he's got swampies. And I think there should be some more help, some more rationalisation given to these people. I think that... I know people get a little bit worried that we should stick to our knitting, as it were, and stick to dairy and sheep. But different ideas and different products to sell on the world markets, I think, are equally important. And the Asian market is a very, very important one to us. And it would hugely increase our market.
Now what about, say, breeding rates, about disease, about the impact on the land?
Oh, make no mistake, the disease thing has been thoroughly gone into. Before we could get in buffalo, there was a lot of negotiation went on with animal health. We had to go through quarantines, we had to go through a huge amount of paperwork and so on. And as far as the European buffalo is concerned, we sent a veterinarian over to Bulgaria to learn how to do embryo transplant so that we could, because they've got some foot and mouth problems and you can't bring in animals from there, but you might be able to bring in an embryo.
Yeah.
And put it into our river buff, into our swampies, and because you can't put them into cows, the gestation period is totally different. Different species, and so you have to be a little bit technical and put them into something in their own species line, in the same genus and so on, so that the gestation is similar. They are a truly wonderful animal. I worked with a guy from up in the Tapawera area who helped us bring the buffaloes into New Zealand, and he had a herd that he had picked up from Arana Park, and Barry was very keen on them, and I can't tell you how impressive as an animal they are and how good they would be to have as an additional genetic resource in New Zealand, and all I can hope is that the beginnings of the industry actually take off and multiply. That's all I can say.
It's one of these ones that is likely to evolve, because when you brought this herd in, it was quite some years ago, and it's nice to know that there are still two or three herds in existence. It's hard to say on today's market where it's going. We're seeing goats now becoming a lot more popular, both from a fact of producing milk and various things being made from goat's milk, and more people are starting to eat goat meat, and it's consumed extensively overseas. So buffalo, I still think, has
potential. I couldn't agree more, and certainly we trialled buffalo steaks in town here at a restaurant in Rangitiki Street, and at the petrol station in Bulls. and we had Buffalo Burgers there. And they got very, very good write-ups, both of them. They are... I think that the potential for them is absolutely colossal. I really honestly do. Their management needs some care. I mean, because they have got a heavy hide and you know, not many pores, which is why you can split it so often, they do get a bit hot in summer, and you've got to, you know, be aware of that. And
so they need a lot of, you talk about swamp buffalo then, and river buffalo. So
well, you can do it with a shower or some sort of a source.
But they need to be on wettish land rather than dry land?
Yeah, but it doesn't matter really. Because they can survive on so little. They are truly amazing animals. I can't understand how they. I've had some very amusing things with them. When I was at Flock House, I took a party of Japanese tourists around. And we stopped and looked at the buffaloes, and two bulls on a roadside paddock decided that was the moment to sort one another out, and they pushed and shoved one another, and one pushed the other one through the fence onto the road, and so two buffalo bulls came down the road at a fair sort of a pace. Do you know you can get 12 Japanese in a bus doorway at the same time? Absolutely true. It was amazing how fast I got back on board the bus.
Now, also one aspect with stock here is if you suddenly get flooding on the farmland and so on, are they more likely to survive those conditions than sheep and cattle?
Oh, heavens yes. Yes. Unless we introduce crocodiles as well. So, yeah.
Thank you for listening to Manawatu Conversations. This and other recent programs can also be found on the Manawatu People's Radio website, and a range of programs is also available on the Manawatu Heritage website of the Palmerston North City Archive. The address for that is manawatuheritage.pncc.govt.nz.
Support this program and others like it by giving a donation to NPR. More details at npr.nz.